America. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, your source for conservative talk. Now, you may be wondering, what the heck does John F. Kennedy, a Democrat, have to do with our conservative talk today? Well, obviously, we all know about his famous quote from his 1961 inaugural address. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. It's a call to civic duty and personal contribution. Some will call this odd, but I've used this ethos as applicable to what we're going to discuss now, the H-1B visa program. We are a nation of settlers, then immigrants, then slaves who were freed, and then immigrants some more. However, when you could get on a boat and go through Ellis Island, it's now a much more complicated process. But it's still the same. We want those who will make this country great. We want highly skilled individuals, the best from around the world, to come to the U.S. to enrich us culturally as well as to help us innovate. And this aligns with Kennedy's vision. We've forgotten this because of an abuse of the system, the H-1B system and other systems, but also a battle of tribalism amongst ourselves. And it's been created by the elites towards the working class, and we're at each other's throats. And it's not going to change. Today's latest battle is the H-1B visa. As I just said, it can be abused, leading to the displacement of American workers. It's not a lot today. But as we know with government programs, they don't ever grow smaller. They grow and grow and grow. And this does reduce the potential for opportunities for Americans to serve their country through their careers. Right now, there's a debate within the Republican Party. It's a heated debate about highly skilled immigration, particularly around this visa. Tech leaders like Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, they're pushing for more visas, citing the need for engineering talent and critiquing American culture for not valuing excellence. Musk, now seen closer to Trump, he's arguing for a permanent shortage change of engineering talent in Silicon Valley. While Ramaswamy, well, he sees the reliance on foreign talent as a symptom of a cultural emphasis on mediocrity. I have to tell you, I agree with Vivek, and we'll talk about that. The advocacy for more H-1B visas meets opposition from MAGA, Make America Great Again supporters. And when you have fringe conservative figures like Laura Loomer criticizing the program, chaos erupts. And I say fringe. She's no longer in the Trump orbit, despite what TDSers want to believe. She did not do anything for Trump this past election. She worked for him on her own, but she is what I call a fringe outlier in some of her beliefs. She lost her ex verification. She's been demonetized, which brings my producer's name, Big John, into the forefront, as he predicted this last week. And I said, that's tomorrow's problem, thinking we're looking at that down the road. Well, down the road took a week. You know, Loomer accused Musk of retaliating against her for her views on immigration, labeling her actions as totalitarian and questioning his commitment to free speech. And that's all true for her to question that, because we're seeing him in action in using the power of X, his platform, to hurt people trying to make money off there, which is what he says X is there for. So before we get into all this discussion, I don't want to bog down my panelists, so I'll explain it to you here real quick. What is the H-1B program? Well, the H-1B visa lets U.S. companies hire foreigners for jobs that need a college education or higher, like in tech or science, what they call STEM. It's not a direct ticket to becoming a U.S. citizen, but it does help fill job gaps. You can stay and work for up to 3 years initially, and then you can get another 3 years, and that's technically the max, though there are various exceptions to extending it. So how does it work? Well, the process starts with a bunch of paperwork. Everything government means a lot of paperwork. The company applies through some government steps, first with the Labor Department to check if they're playing fair with the wages, which they're not, they still get away with it. Then with another agency to say, hey, we need this worker, which at times they do, But as we're finding out, they don't. They just want cheaper labor. There's only so many spots each year. So if too many companies or people, too many companies apply to sponsor people, they do a lottery. You can't just apply yourself as an individual. You need a job offer from an American company. And while the H-1B isn't meant to make you a permanent U.S. resident, it's often the first step for many to do that. So that's when the debate gets heated, especially when folks like Elon Musk talk about bringing in the best of the best, which some people within the MAGA community don't agree with or misunderstand, because we do want the best of the best. And this is what's leading to heated debate about jobs and what it means to be American. So with an H-1B, you're legally allowed to work here, bring your family, and potentially apply to stay forever. But the program stirs up debate because it touches on jobs, culture, and who gets to come to America. Knowing how this visa works is key to understanding the debate and what we should really do. This is a discussion that actually needs to be had. And with that, let me introduce our panel for tonight, as our producer will bring them on one by one. Oh, looks like our producer, there we go.
All right.
So first of all, everybody, let's welcome back G. Mangani and the beautiful Miss Annette Roche from their Christmas slumber. And I hope you two had a good vacation. But before we get to you two, because you two are regular, so we don't care. I'm kidding. I want you to introduce our guest, and that is Rachel Laffer and her husband, Nikolai, I believe you said. Nikolai, we have not met. I just first heard your name today, just now.
Well, you got it spot on, so that's good.
Rachel, if you can tell us a little bit about yourself. And then Nikolai, for the audience, I'm not going to tease this. He's an H-1B recipient, and his insight, I think, is important to this discussion, whether you agree with him or not. We always view individuals who are actually using whatever it is we're talking about as just objects in a discussion. So it's great to have somebody here like that. So, Ms. Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I used to work for the Wall Street Journal editorial page for quite some time. Then kind of got the bug to live in Europe, and so spent some time at the Wall Street Journal Europe in Brussels, so learned a lot about all the bureaucracy that occurs over there, and then decided to stay there and work for a hedge fund and a real estate, a commercial real estate investment management company, and decided to come back to California about a decade or so ago with my husband, who's English. We met in London. And so that's where the H-1B comes in. It was a lifesaver for us.
I came here kicking and screaming against my will to the beaches of California.
That's a good one. You know, it's funny you say that, because as you're talking, I'm thinking the military. My mother came here because my dad's Puerto Rican, married my mother, Panamanian. So that's how she got here. And that just shows there's various paths to get to America. It's no longer just Ellis Island. And to the audience, if you've never visited Ellis Island, I view myself as a tough guy, but I broke down in tears. Those pictures are heartbreaking. You see those individuals, it's black and white. It's just you need to go to Ellis Island if you've never seen it. So let's get into this. This started with Elon Musk and Laura Loomer. When Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, appointed Sriram Krishun as the senior policy advisor for AI. So she had criticized the appointment because Krishan, he supports expanding the H-1B visas. And that goes contrary in Loomer's eyes. It goes against America's first policies. I want to show an image here. It's from Vivek. That's the first discussion I want to get into. Vivek gave a long-winded, poorly worded post, and what he was saying is our dilemma, he doesn't say it, but what I'm translating is how I understood it. To me, what I heard him say is, when we started giving out trophies to everybody, began the decline of excellence in America and mediocrity. The problem is he said it very poorly in terms of how he worded it. What are your thoughts in terms of what Vivek said?
Well, he was inarticulately, I would say, trying to address the idea of and let me start with TikTok. So TikTok, the kids, that the content that the TikTok pushes to kids in China are all about science experiments and spelling bees and things that would bore most American kids. The stuff they push to us is sports and people dancing crazy, boobs and butts. I mean, so I think in the long run, Vivek is trying to say, like, what we value as a society is not necessarily academics. It's more athletics. It's more cultural. And it's not producing the amount of talent that is produced in China or India. And we need those people over here to help us produce our – or produce stuff in our society to advance our society. That's what he was trying to say. To say that the whole country pushes for mediocrity, just a bad way of putting it.
Exactly. And here's what the post, the expo says. I've said it countless times in the last few years. Oh, no, I'm wrong. I'm ahead of the game here. This is that's actually the post of what he said in terms of what I think he truly believes. I apologize to the audience. Miss Annette, what she said is so political. You should run for office. Very well said, G, in such a way. What I got out of it is, so he's saying, you Americans, we're entitled. We think we're owed everything. We don't want to work hard. We'd rather game. We'd rather throw our butts in the air and be mini Kardashians. And we'd rather do everything but actually study. That's what I got out of it. And I say it this way because I'm a crass blue-collar guy, but I agree with Vivek. I was one of those kids, and it took the military for me to realize how stupid and ignorant I was with life. And I think that's what he's saying. He said it poorly. G said it beautifully. What are your thoughts?
G, you mean like the sea and the spa TikToks that we see all the time when someone's vacationing? I would say it's an opportunity for us to talk about how our education system is failing our kids. Why is that what Vivek is trying to point to? And that is a cultural problem that we're having, that we're not doing a good job, especially with public education, educating our students and educating our workforce.
You know, I think you're aligned there with G and myself. Rachel and Nikolai, from your perspective, you traveled obviously to Europe. You've seen different cultures there. I'm sure you probably hopped on the train, you know, and saw various countries. And Nikolai, you've been in Europe there, and now you're in America. Now, my belief in what I just said came from being in Panama and traveling to 30-some-odd countries and seeing how we're squandering what we have here in greatness. How do you two see it?
Well, I definitely think the Europeans are almost overly educated. I mean, it's extraordinary. You go to Italy, you go to Germany. I mean, Germans speak better English than Americans do. I mean, so I do think that there is very much something to say about the culture that we've kind of inculcated here in America, at least now, where I do think kids are just watching TikTok and there's not that fire in their belly that you see, you know, in other places. I think it was just said poorly. I don't know if that's necessarily saying the entire culture is wrong. I do believe in sleepovers. I don't think every mom has to be a tiger mom. I do think that there's certain aspects to what was being said or discussed I think that there's a happy medium in all of this. So that's my feeling.
But without mentioning any schools by name, my impression is that a child who is, for example, 15 in the US would be about 4 or 5 years behind in terms of maths and English what they would be in the UK. That's just the impression I get. I think there is this culture in the US of encouraging people by talking about free speech to care less about their studies, because it doesn't matter, you're still a beautiful person and you'll be fine in life. And I think that there's definitely a problem in this country, which is that we're not strict enough on education. It doesn't seem to me there's no punishment for not doing well at school anymore.
Yeah. And I always say, like, you know, if you're going to follow a certain demographics in this country, I'm always like to our daughter, follow those kids. Like, there's certain demographics. I won't say them. I don't know if you can anymore. But, like, you know, you follow those kids because those parents are, you know, hardcore. They, you know, they believe in, you know, in having strong academic background. And, you know, there's certain cultures that tend to you know, weigh certain things or have certain values with regards to raising their children. And one is, you know, really, you know, getting good grades, you know, listening to the teacher, you know, having certain rules and regulations that they abide by. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't see that in the overall kind of American culture. Whereas in Asian societies or in the Jewish culture, it seems like there's certain groups where the education is put at the top.
And I think that the UK and Europe is definitely one of those continents where education is still considered to be number one.
And Shades of Tiger Mom, what Rachel's trying to say, people, is there's a great book out there. You have to read it. And she's absolutely right. Certain cultures push education much harder. They understand the value. We create stereotypes out of this. With the Asian culture, oh, they're the math wizards. Oh, the Jewish culture, they're the financial wizards. No, it's about teaching the value of education, yeah. teaching the value of saving your money and investing it well. Anybody help me. I can't remember her name, the professor's name who wrote the book, and they call her the Tiger Mom. And that's what she's talking about. And she got a lot of pushback for that. They claim, oh, you're racist. You shouldn't say this because of what you were saying too, as well, Rachel and Nikolai. We are in everybody gets a participation trophy. Nikolai, you're spot on. We did a show maybe a few months back with school board education candidates, and I brought up a lot of numbers. And the one number that I've never forgotten is that this was maybe 25, 30 years ago, and it hasn't really changed, is that black children in the LA district were graduating at an eighth grade level. So you are absolutely right.
Franchising the community. I think that is so tragic. For that particular community, for those types of statistics, I mean, how much are they just destroying those children's lives and their futures? It's just, you know, all for so a teacher can, you know, get tenure. It blows my mind.
And don't forget also, of course, that in the developing world, a good education and coming top of your class opens doors to a better life for your family and you. So that's another reason why it's so important in, for example, the developing world versus what it is in the States, where there's not much pressure on how well you do because it doesn't matter because you're going to be fine anyway. And as you say, what's happening is the black kids in LA are not able to do what the people in the developing world are doing. There's no way out for these guys because they're stuck in the same system and it's not changing.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm proud to sit there and say, my mother came here, she worked in a factory, she had her dream, she sent all her money back to Panama. When I tell people, you don't know what poor is, so you go see a third world country poor, and that's where my mom's side came from. She paid for my aunt's education. My aunt got a master's. She went from dirt poor to what would be seen as middle class, and that's a big exponential leap, you know, so you are absolutely right, Nikolai.
Man, let me throw out one more statistic, because this is more widespread in California. 42%, and this is before COVID, 42% of kids meet or exceed the standards in California. So you flip that and you go 58% of kids do not meet or exceed, not meet the standards. So, I mean, I'm happy in our school we're at about 90%, but that means we're pulling the average up, right? So many schools are way, way down there.
Right. Well, I want to keep moving here. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To what Rachel, I think, was maybe saying, or Nikolai, maybe it's not, but I mean, despite Rachel, you said the lack of rigor that is existing, but also they're selling our kids, I know, because of our daughters, which I love to bring them up all the time, that they can be like an influencer. Like, you don't need to, like, education is not valued. You know, you can sell yourself in some way influencing. I'm sorry, but did anyone see the story about the lady making all the money on OnlyFans? That was a huge conversation in our house. No, it's true though. Where she is making over six figures a month, exploiting herself, and the girl's like, "Wow, mom, why wouldn't that be easy money for anybody? Why bother getting an education?"
Yeah,
yeah,
it's true though. It's true.
Well, and our producer chimes in. We're not even talking about your ability to get a job and make a living. How about just, you know, the education of yourself and finding out who you are through an education. I think that there's something to say about that, not just the economical aspect of it. There's something about just being like a complete human being. By
cultivated. Yes.
But just going back to the very, very beginning and the discussion on H-1B visas, there clearly has to be far more of a balance, right, between who's coming in, what they're doing, what makes them more skilled than an American person that's already here. There needs to be probably a bit more of a fine balance, because this could be the exact reason that the kids you mentioned in LA are not having the chance to escape the hell that they live in, because it's too easy, or not in some cases, to get here. So there clearly has to be a review of the system, and just to find a balance. It's not easy.
Right.
But yeah. H-1Bs, it's the American dream. How could anyone not see it as if it's used properly? H-1B visas it basically epitomize the American dream. An immigrant coming here, who is skilled, who can apply himself or herself and fulfill their dreams and have their
family. Well, that's what you're going to talk about, because what you're saying is not exactly what the H-1B was created for. That's why I think it's important to have this discussion. It's not that I'm against H-1B, but it's like we need to know what it is, how it really works. So let's get into that discussion here real quick. Great topic. I mean, we got a little sidetracked, guys, but it was a great topic. It needed to be had. My answer is always the same. Annette has asked me more than once, well, what do we do? My answer is always educate our damn kids. And that's not what we're doing right now. So getting back to this is what Elon Musk emphasized his support to bring the 0.1% of engineering talent. And that's what he put in his X post here. Maybe this is a helpful clarification. I am referring to bringing in via legal immigration the top 0.1% of engineering talent as being essential for America to keep winning. And then he aligned it with like bringing in Jokic or Wemby's. And gee, real quick, what's that other visa? Because that's what they really use for those
the
players.
The O-1B, which is extraordinary talent.
Right. It's ironic.
I definitely didn't get one of those. I was crossed off.
Well, it's funny because he uses the example he used was great, but they actually use another visa for those type of players. So the reason I wanted to bring this up is Tesla in 2024 significantly escalated its utilization of the H-1B visa. They had like 742 approved visas at one point. And it was more than double their 328 in 2023. And they had over 1,000 petitions. So here's where the is there any hypocrisy? Tesla laid off about 15,000 employees last year. And then they requested over 2,000 more H-1B visas. And we're going to get into this. But the problem here is people are saying, hey, we have qualified Americans. You're firing them, and you're using the H-1B. I don't want to get into too much detail, so just give me your initial thoughts on this. And Rachel and Nikolai, I'm always going to come to you guys last because of your unique perspectives. So it's not that I'm picking you last. So Ms. Annette, let's start with you on this one first. What are your thoughts in terms of a little bit of hypocrisy here, in terms of laying off that many people than asking for exponentially more H-1B? There's no right or wrong answer. Just your thoughts when you see that.
No, I know. I mean, I just feel like this is not – are you saying that you think that Elon is being a little bit disingenuous here? Is that your point between what he just said and the
– Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I look at this like he's doing what he needs to do to benefit – himself. And I guess that's my worry about this a little tiny bit. That once again, the people that are losers are the American workers. But I'm not saying, and I sort of said, Rachel sort of said this earlier, it's like, why is this an all or nothing proposition? There should be the opportunity here for the American dream for some people. So I don't necessarily see it has to be like a very staunch like no, or a very strong like we got to bring in as many as we can. I just think like everybody else, Elon, I love him for what he's done. He's not perfect in my opinion. And he's sort of playing a little bit of both sides.
That's a great answer, because I think that's how most sane Americans actually look at it. Gee, your thoughts on when you see a little hypocrisy here?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to tell because who was fired, who's brought in, what job roles were they playing? I mean, this is just a little talking point that, maybe he fired a bunch of tech support and brought in a bunch of engineers. I mean, let's, to drill down would be more interesting to for me to find out. But I will say that, I mean, that this should be a fear of a lot of Americans, is that you're just replacing with cheaper labor. But then I'm a free market guy. A company should be able to do that. If someone's willing to do the same job for $20,000 less, I, as a business owner, should be able to hire that person and lay off the other person. It's just not good politics, though. So that's why this is a political thing, but this is happening all across the country in many companies. So is it hypocritical? Well, no, he has a right to do it.
Right. But here's the problem. It's not a free market. This is a visa program that's set by the government, and there's no free market in it. It's a set-up system by the government. If we had a true free market, there would be more Latinos, more Africans, more Europeans. This is 70% Indian. So because and not the fault Indians, they've set up a great program over there where, in essence, our side can literally pick up a phone and get the qualified individual. Rachel and Nikolai, your thoughts? A little bit hip-hop. And before you answer, though, G's right. I did try to drill down, and I couldn't find the data in terms of if he just fired, you know, who he fired and who he replaced. So he's right. This is a bit of a talking point.
I think G's point is very valid, that as the CEO of a company, you or he or she or we all have the right to want to pay people less. That's fair enough. I can liken the situation to how things were in Europe after we opened up, free movement of labor within Europe. The good thing was that people from Poland and Germany and Ukraine and Greece and wherever it were coming over and doing the jobs. This is, you know, the same in America, but doing the jobs that no English people would do and doing them a lot better and costing them less. So I don't know the exact Elon Musk situation, but if you had the choice to hire, you know, some lazy, entitled American kids or from India where, you know, or China, where they just work constantly all day, every day, and you're going to trust that they're going to be at work when you want them to be at work. I do remember during COVID, there was a time when Elon wanted everyone back at work much more early than a lot of companies, and he had a big problem getting people back to work after COVID. So I kind of understand where he's coming from, you know, and if I'm in London, for example, and I run a pub, I'm not going to want English people working for me because they're going to turn up drunk and not do the work. But if I get Polish people, their entire life depends on working for me, and they're going to work their butts off and send every single penny back home to, you know, their family. And that's the type of people you want in America.
Right. No, you're right. Actually, again, I can point to my mother as an example. She came here. She worked in the factory. She worked in the yarn for our factory. Everybody had a base level. They had to, it's like, you will do this before you go home or your job is in jeopardy. But then after that base level of production, everything was bonus. So,
right.
They resented my mother, and they were Black American women, White American women, and Asian American women. That's who, and they were all American. They weren't immigrants. They were Americans. Her supervisor took her aside and said, Clemencia, that's my mother's name, don't worry about those people. Worry about yourself. I'll watch out for you. They would ostracize her because she worked harder than them. And that has nothing to do with culture, except for the grand American culture where we got in complacent. Rachel, before we move on from here, your thoughts real quick.
So I agree with G, and definitely, but I do understand what you're saying is that you're saying it's not really a free, you know, free flow of capital and goods. This is a different argument altogether. But, you know, my argument has always been why buy American? I always hated that slogan because it's like you only buy American if it's, you know, their goods that are good, are high quality and are at the best price. Like you're just not going to, no matter how much of a patriot I am, I'm sorry. Everyone loves the bottom line. But I agree with you that this is a little bit different of a scenario. And so I do think, looking at something like the Singaporean model, where, you know, you do make sure that the immigrant, possible prospective employees are paid a fair wage or something that in some way mirrors, not completely, but what what
Hold that thought, Rachel. I want to show this video on Tucker, and then we'll get into it. And what you said, Rachel, is an ugly truth. You are absolutely correct. As much as I want to buy American, if it's $15 more than the next thing on the counter, I look at my pocketbook, I look at my bank savings, I go, hey, China, here we come. You know, that's just human nature. So I want to show the ugly side of this. I'm a Tucker fan, but I don't think he said this well, but you can sense the anger in him. And this is how a lot of MAGA thinks.
And its workforce. Meanwhile, during the same period, the federal government has approved hundreds of new H-1B visas for Uber. And that means they can replace those workers with foreign scabs who will work for less. It's like outsourcing, but even easier because Uber doesn't even have to build a new building. Now, there's nothing unusual.
Now, the first thing I want everybody to know and for the audience is Uber is not IT. You know, there's a whole swath in terms of some of the jobs he was talking. Maybe some of them were IT, but not a lot of them.
About what Uber is doing. There's bipartisan consensus in Washington that we desperately need smart people from overseas to do the jobs that Americans are too badly educated to do. No reason to fix our schools or make sure higher education is serious and non-frivolous. We can just import people from countries that take education seriously.
And that's everything we've discussed so far.
He didn't leave me after all that because he said exactly what I said at the beginning.
Exactly. Why aren't you on Fox, Nikolai?
I know, seriously, yeah. I wouldn't last very long. I defend someone.
And that's what we do. That's why the U.S. government passes out foreign worker visas to allow corporations to replace people like you with people who live 6,000 miles away. Now, you probably haven't even heard of the F1 optional practical training program, but in just 4 years.
Okay, so he gets into some details there. I wanted to play it, but we get the gist. What I want you all to take out of that is notice his anger. You know, this is what they're doing, and there's consensus about it. But then he also acknowledges why. The education. And I wanted to show that clip because it embodied. I was debating, do we have time for it? But that clip, what I just showed, embodied what we've been talking about. So it's not rocket science. And I think the part of the problem we're having in today's discussion, not us, but the public with this, is they're angry and they're emotional and they're not thinking rationally. This is how we fix a problem. Right now, they're like blame India, you know, blame the rich, blame the elites, blame G, you know, that it's just too emotional and we need to bring it down. But there is a problem is it is cheaper labor. Some companies are exploiting the H-1B program to hire less expensive foreign workers. And then this is the part that's not talked about that really irks me is these same corporations hold these H-1B employees hostage who, as you talked about the American dream, they want to do certain things. They're locked in. Do as we say, or we're not going to sponsor you the next 3 years. So it is an ugly situation. Now, the stance before the election, Trump's election, during the election season, Trump advocated for reducing H-1B visas. He criticized them for displacing American workers. And that seems to contrast much support for skilled immigration. Now, Vivek Ramaswamy, this is where he agrees with kind of what we're saying here. And that's where I actually wanted to post this, what he actually said here. And he said, I've said it countless times in the last 2 years and will say it again. The H-1B system is badly broken and should be replaced with one that focuses on selecting the very best of the best, not a lottery. Pro-competitive, no indentured service to one company, and de-bureaucratize. Now, I don't think the H-1B program should be replaced. It should just be used for how it was used. And we have other programs that can get other forms of labor in. But that's what I mean by the miscommunication. I think he was just trying to say the reason we have this H-1B program is because we aren't doing the job. And Elon Musk's stance has not really changed, you know. So I'm going to jump down here to the Singapore because, Rachel, you brought up a good point. One of the ways you can fix this is through payment. If they're forced to pay the equal wage, meaning there's a minimum, who do they hire, the foreign worker? Or do they hire the local American? All of a sudden, it changes the dynamics versus, hey, let's use the H-1B program, and we can save $30,000. And if we get X amount of people here, we can save even more. And in fact, I don't want to spill the beans because I didn't ask John, Big John, our producer, he's a VP at a corporation. He sees this all the time, you know, in terms of, well, they're just going to let go of this swath of people and they're going to hire all Indians. He goes, again, and poor John's the hatchet man at times. So he sees this. And he just informed me that we know what the answer would be. They would hire the American because it cost them about $60,000 to bring someone over via the H-1B. Rachel, you mentioned Singapore. Tell us a little bit about the Singapore program if you want.
Well, no, I mean, because you had provided us with some information that I had been looking at, and it just seems like, you know, maybe you don't have a lottery, like Ramaswamy said. You don't do it that way. It really should just go to the highest skilled workers. I mean, I think you need to just make it a little bit more meritocratic in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, if that's what you're looking for, if that's where the gap really is, then let's do it that way. You know, and, you know, at the same time, work on, you know, STEM programs and stuff like that in the States and, you know, at the lower rungs of education. So kids really are getting, American kids are getting that exposure, but it's not instantaneous. You know, so I think that there are I think there are ways to not completely just, I don't think we should basically just completely, you know, rip out this particular model. I just think that it needs to be refined. Like I said, I think it's the H-1B is great if it's used properly. And you don't want situations where companies are abusing employees and taking advantage and yada, yada, yada.
But you also don't want employees abusing the system either, right? Which is another issue.
Right. That issue is more along the lines of the Indian companies who have swaths of these people pre-approved from their end, ready to go. So, gee, real quick, Singapore implemented policies to ensure that foreign workers are paid a fair wage to protect local workers. So, in essence, what they're saying is, hey, if you're paying our Singaporean employees $60,000 and you want to use the H-1B or their version of it, which is the employment pass, you're going to pay that foreigner $60,000. So they've done that. They've also created something called a progressive wage model that sets minimum wage levels for certain sectors. Again, to protect the local worker. And in our case, it will protect the American worker because you have some a process costing $60,000 per employee. All of a sudden, the American worker is more attractive. Gee, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I work with a lot of companies and my own company where I've hired these guys and we hire them remotely. And there's a misunderstanding in terms of, okay, maybe their skill level and programming, I'm in software, I didn't say that earlier. Their skill level is high, but their culture is completely different. And I'll give you an example. So there was this one time where about 10 years ago, we were in a conference room here and we were conferencing with the guys in Taiwan. These were Taiwanese people, not Indian. And we were just brainstorming on our side. Well, maybe we should add this feature. And when we hung up, we just thought, okay, that was a great brainstorming session. We get into work, and that was our late afternoon. That was their early morning. When we got back into work the next day, they had fully implemented the feature. They had spent the whole day doing it. And we looked at them saying, wait, we didn't want this. We were just throwing out ideas. Now you wasted a whole day throwing this feature in that we don't actually even want. And this is also in India too. There is a sense of, okay, if you tell us what to do, we'll just do it. And if we think you told us what to do, we'll just do it. Instead of having some kind of like leadership and personal responsibility. So I say all that because that's a long-winded explanation of what happened is a lot of companies won't even hire these guys for $40,000 a year remotely because the quality of work that comes across is because of miscommunication or, you know, non-overlapping hours. It's just better to hire someone here for $120,000 and you'll get more done at $120,000 than hiring three of those guys at $40,000 and you don't know what they're doing all day. So by bringing them over, if you can get that same person for $50,000, well, maybe now there's a value proposition, right? So, but then there's a culture clash. So I think that Singaporean model would work because what you said earlier is if I could just hire an American for the same amount and we get along and the culture's fine. And I'm Indian, so I can say this. And Americans wear deodorant and Indians don't. So our office won't stink. I think, and I've got stories behind that one too, but I won't get into it right now. But I think a lot of companies out there will go, you know what, we'll just hire the American and call it a day.
Gee, I think you crossed the line there. Every Indian next time they see you is going to slap you. Do not go into 7-Eleven. I'm terrible. I'm terrible.
No, they're going to slap you. Yeah, now you're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's right. You're not Indian.
I tell Big John, us Latinos, we get away with murder, as do blacks, as do Indians. That's one thing I do feel bad for white America. They're the only people who can't say anything, right, Miss Annette? Miss Annette, what are your thoughts on the Singapore model and having a base salary to protect local workers?
Well, I guess I have a question more than anything. Gee, that was a really great example. But, like, it's great. It's to Rachel's point about refinement. They're refining it, right? And that's a good thing that we need to look at. That's what Vivek was saying. We need to take a look at this, and we can do it better. And if the Singapore model is to try to be a little more equitable in how they're paying people. But who is to say – I guess my question is, who decides who's being exploited? You know what I'm asking? The question I'm asking is it if the worker accepts a wage and they don't feel they're being exploited, can I say that I think they're being exploited?
Yes. Yes, you can. And here's why. Our producer chimed in. First of all, he says, thank God for boobs and butts in regards to our earlier conversations. Then he says communism sucks in terms of when we talked about there is no free market. And he says the free market decides. In terms of who should, if somebody's being exploited, yeah. And he's right.
I agree that that is the free market. If I'm willing to
accept it's not. It's not the free market. It's not the free market because this is a program that's been set by the government, right. Goes through a process, and it's not open to everybody. It's a select few, and they can specifically hire somebody, underpay them, and while the American worker gets displaced. So the person who can technically, the go beyond what Big John said, who can scream exploitation is the American worker because he sees that the industry across the board is paying $100,000, for example, for this job in this industry. But the exceptions are all the H-1B people getting paid $70,000 per worker. So that's the exploitation. Now, G brings up very good points because we work with an Indian company, and I had the conversation with their president one-on-one. Your guys aren't creative. I need them to be more creative. They just do as they're told, this or that. And we talked about how do we make it more creative. So there is that imbalance. So maybe that is what their value is. I don't know. But from an American standard, that would be deemed exploitation. But I'm not the economy person here. Ms. Rachel is. Your thoughts on what would be deemed exploitation?
Oh, God. I mean, I agree with Annette. I mean, if someone is willing to... If someone is willing to accept a particular wage, then it should be okay. I mean, but like you said, I mean, this is a different situation because, you know, this is a government program, yada, yada, yada. But and again, it goes back to, are we really talking about very highly skilled people that are actually filling a gap? A real gap. And I mean, I think this is what has to happen. Is it a real gap? Because we all know that U.S. growth is never going to continue if we do not have immigrants coming into this country and filling, you know, highly skilled roles that we cannot produce ourselves in this country. That's what's happening. It's been happening for a long time.
You're right. Let's get to this segment then. Specific. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Nikolai. But I'm going to give you specific examples.
You're talking about exploitation, and I was talking about exploitation from both sides, the employer and the employee. I know from experience that, you know, that on an application for an H-1B visa, you certainly embellish certain things about your wherewithal and ability and your, you know, talents versus others. I know that's happening because I've been through the process. So that's, I think, the exploitation from the employee side, just to, before you go on.
Well, I'll give a little pushback, not hard pushback, only because you look at everybody's resume. You know, we do the same thing on resumes. So I would forgive the employee. But let's talk about exploitation before we get into specific examples. There's a lack of mobility for H-1B workers. Due to visa conditions, these workers, they're tied to their sponsors, limiting their ability to switch jobs. It's a legal limbo for workers. They often remain in legal limbo for decades with their visa status dependent on the sponsoring company. We've already talked about the impact on salary and benefits. And then obviously the unfair competition for American workers. So those are examples of the exploitation on both sides. I think I'm going to have to go look at my resume again.
Now, the other thing which I have always had a huge issue with, and I don't know if you're going to get to it at some point. Personally, I feel that if you are employed in the U.S. and you are paying state and or federal taxes, you should have the right to vote. This is a whole nother topic altogether. We could probably do a whole nother podcast just on that. But I do think it's pretty outrageous that you pay tax to the government but don't have the right to vote.
Interesting.
That would be the first
thing. We'll have that. It's not just H-1B, it's visa. But that, because that's a good push, because I completely disagree. But you're right, that's another podcast. But you're right, the reason we should have that is because politicians want illegals to vote. You know,
exactly.
You know, so that's a great topic, actually. Okay, so let's get into this. Yeah, let's get into some examples of what Rachel was talking about, you know, how the H-1B program is used in the qualifications. In Southern California, Edison, in our neck of the woods here, in 2014, they replaced 400 IT employees with lower paid foreign workers brought in through the H-1B program. And why is that important? It's supposed to, the visa program is supposed to be for individuals where there aren't Americans to do those jobs. Disney in 2014 laid off many of its IT workers and replaced them with outsourced talent. To make it worse, I remember when that happened, and I remember employees going on X or Twitter at the time stating, "I'm training my replacement, and I have to, or I won't get my severance package." You know, in 2008, Big Pharma replaced workers at its New London and Groton R&D department. Well, maybe that was a legit one there, R&D, you know. Now, the reason I think that's important is, Rachel, that goes to your point. We'll start with you, actually, on this one. That validates what you're saying. What are your thoughts when you hear that?
That's revolting. I mean, I'd be furious if I was a worker and, you know, like you said, I mean, how galling to sit there and have to train someone that's taking your job, you know, at a lower wage, who's not as skilled or maybe has the same skill as you. I mean, that is not what this program's about. I mean, that is certainly not what I'm supporting in any way. You know, this is all about someone that has qualifications, that don't exist, or, you know, are very hard to find in an American workforce. That's the whole point of this. That's the raison d'etre of this whole program. Mm-hmm. So if that is not happening, then I'm not in agreement of it at all. I mean, that is totally exploitative. I mean, that's ridiculous.
I drill down. These instances did happen. G, your thoughts when you see something like this? We can't hear you.
I can't hear me either.
I can't hear. Yeah. Annette, you go.
I don't know why it keeps going
G.
on mute.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, sorry. So I agree with Rachel. I think 10 years ago when we hired those engineers, it's because we just didn't have enough money to hire all local. So we had, I believe it was 10 engineers local, highly qualified people, and then we augmented that with a team of 40, and we just couldn't hire 40 Americans, right? So it was an augmentation of that. Now you could argue, okay, we could have hired 10 more Americans or whatnot, but we were able to get more done. And the money actually came from Taiwan. The guy who funded the whole operation was a Taiwanese billionaire. So the money came from Taiwan to here and then kind of went back to Taiwan. So I would say no. To replace workers, no, absolutely not. But to augment, I think, it's a good way to do that, because I'll tell you, America's graduating, and this statistic's maybe 15 years old, graduating 100,000 software engineers a year, whereas India alone is graduating 800,000 a year. Now, that statistic's 10 years old. But there's a bunch of software engineers sitting in India jobless, and just about every software engineer here in America has a job, and they're making $200,000 to $300,000.
That's the same ratio versus the population, isn't it, roughly?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I actually did some research on that. I didn't put it in our notes, but I can't remember the number, but I want to say there's like three – whatever it is, approximately 50% are foreigners graduating STEM versus Americans. And the number's actually very low. I mean, we do have – just looking at those numbers, I was like, we do have a problem creating engineers and IT techs. But I mean, we're talking maybe less than a million graduating every year. So, Ms. Annette, before we go to you, I want to drill down even deeper. I double-checked these numbers, and they are true. It's not just IT that H-1B visas are being used for. Cashiers at Toys R Us. Mm-hmm. Toys R Us use H-1B visas to hire cashiers and warehouse workers. God, somebody's going to slap me. Retail sales associates at 7-Eleven, you know, were found to have used H-1B visas.
And we know Indians own most of those, right?
Customer service representatives at Disney also use them, H-1B. Hotel staff at Marriott. So these are not IT jobs. These are blue collar. And the reason I brought this up specifically, Annette, is, and we're not going to talk about, we're running out of time, but Thomas Sowell and Big John's good friend, Larry Sharp, a libertarian, he talked about the component. Everybody saying, oh, you're white, racist, make America great again. You don't want these Indians. You don't want these people just because they're foreigners. No, there's a fear. It's the base of make America great again is working class Americans and the bulk of them being white. This is the fear Larry Sharp talked about in a podcast or off camera with Big John and I. They're scared. You know, what are your thoughts when you see these non-tech IT tech jobs going to H-1B visa applicants?
Well, yeah, that's obviously not what should be the intent at all. And obviously Trump's promise to the American people were, especially to the middle class, was like, I feel your pain. I relate to you. I'm on your side. You know what I mean? I get your plight, and this is the exact opposite. You know, this is how it is being. But like anything else, this is the thing about, it's always this this idea that Rachel talked about, where it's sort of like more niche, and we actually have a need that's being fulfilled by people, and then in that pursuit, maybe they're having the American dream happen for them. I mean, that's a beautiful concept. And then, of course, there's people and companies like maybe like Disney that abuse that and use it in ways that are not good. And they kill the spirit of the American worker. And then those people become more discouraged and more disenfranchised. And you know how it goes from there.
Correct. Nikolai, we're going to close this out here in a few minutes because I want to go to our hot takes. And there's so much more we can talk about. Yeah. But, I would actually like to hear your perspective as somebody with an H-1B visa based off everything we've talked about as the battle that's happening. What are your heartfelt beliefs in this, good or bad, as somebody who is on an H-1B visa?
Well, I mean, I'm delighted that the system exists because, as we found out, it was far easier for me to come to America by virtue of being a skilled worker than it was by dint of having been unfortunate enough to marry an American. So I'm obviously delighted that it exists. Now, I was lucky because after, I think it's 5 years, I was able to apply. No, it's not 5 years. It's after six. I was able to apply for a full right to work. And then after 10 years to become a citizen. So I do think that, you know, from a selfish point of view, I'm delighted the program exists. There needs to be more checks and balances on both sides, the employer and the employees, of who's coming, clearly, because the system can be manipulated, as we've discussed, on both sides. And I do think a very important point too is, since I've been living in the States, I've seen plenty of the abject poverty that we're talking about in places like China and India. I've seen that in Kentucky and Mississippi and Missouri and other places like that. And I think it's, you know, a very, we have a problem, a homegrown problem right in America that we could solve within America by employing people that are living these horrific lives in, you know, in drug dens and whatever else it is in the South. So that's an important thing, which I think, you know, and yeah, so we're talking about going abroad, but there's plenty of people here that live in the same type of poverty that I imagine people live in India. And I don't think we're doing anything to help these people. And then, of course, we have a drug epidemic, which no one talks about. It's like, don't believe your lying eyes. And it's all born from lack of education, lack of job opportunity, and, lack of employment.
I was going to jump in and say, you know, it all boils down to, in my eyes, to one thing, education. I did not realize the importance of education until I did not know what I was going to do with my life when my term in the military was coming to an end. I was like, oh, my God, I got to go to college. I am 5'7". I will break my back in 5 years digging ditches. You know, I have got to go. I'm a white collar bound man, you know. So the final topic before we get into our hot takes, and Nicolai, I don't know how much you can give your perspective on this, but the ramifications for this intra-MAGA battle. The reason I bring this up is I look at the big picture, 2026. Gee, thank you for correcting me many moons ago. I kept saying 2022, 2026, the midterms. Traditionally, the opposing party wins the midterms, but that's been up and down a few times over the last generation. I think this could destroy the potential midterm gains that Republicans can make because the Democrats are not backing down of their tribalistic identity politics, despite the fact that every indicator says Americans don't want that, don't care for that. But I think the Trump voter is not an every cycle voter. They voted for Trump. I think if this goes on, Elon will fragment the party and we will pay the price in 2026. G, let's start off with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that this is a battle that's going to last for more than a few months. I mean, when things come up at the school board, I always tell Annette, like, in about 3 months, this will be like 3 years ago. I mean, political memory is very, very short, right? Unless it's very big. And this is a big issue, but it's not the explosive issue that I think is going to define the midterms. And I think that's going to be immigration, whether that whole thing is working or not. It's not going to, I mean, H-1B is part of immigration, but this is like the small part. There's a big problem with immigration. That's going to be the defining issue for 2026.
You know, that's a damn good point. I hadn't even thought about it. This could be over in a few months. Ms. Annette, your thoughts?
I'm just thankful that G is right about that because he is right about many things, and one is that things can sort of have a short cycle. I agree, though. When you have that as a question, I was like, I don't see it right now as the deal breaker for 2026 at all. I mean, it is like it's not illegal immigration. It's a legal visa. And there are some things to be worked out, but it seems like some people are on that and they want to do those refinements. So I'm not super concerned about it yet in that way.
Ms. Rachel and Nicolai, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is a Reagan realignment. This was, you know, again, that, you know, I felt like the blue collar worker was completely negated by the elites of the Democrat Party. I don't think that's going away any soon. And you see it because they're not even the Democrats still have not realized what they've done wrong. They're digging in even harder. So yeah. I do not see this. I totally agree with G. I think this is much more of a peripheral issue. And actually, when you brought this topic up for us to discuss, I thought how ironic that we're really focusing so much time on H-1B, you know, a legal process to allow immigrants to come to our country, when really what the Democrats have failed us completely on that we're seeing on this border right here is illegal immigration and not the legal process of migration, which I think everyone believes in if you believe in the American dream. And I just want to say one more thing. You talked about John F. Kennedy in the beginning, and he's the biggest supply sider, even though he's a Democrat. He cut the highest marginal tax rate from 91% to 70%. So even though we think of every Democrat as being a certain way, Kennedy was, rising tide lifts all boats, and one of the biggest supply siders. So it's good to remember.
That's a good point. And I'll add to it, for those of you out there, Democrats who consistently talk about toxic masculinity, it was that toxic masculinity that gave us a sea, air, and land elite spec op warriors in the SEALs. He sat there and said, those Green Berets aren't going to get all the glory, and started the SEAL program, which actually he took the BUDS program, which was basic underwater demolition, and from World War II. That's some cool stuff there.
I'll just add two things, if I can, before everyone leaves.
Yes, sir.
I personally believe this election was simply a referendum on elitist politicians in politics. I think that's how people voted this time. The last thing I'll leave you with is that 2026 is when the Soccer World Cup is coming to the USA, and that's the only thing that anyone should be focused on in 2026.
Is that a real word? And I'm Latino and saying that, I'm going to get slapped. When I was in Panama many years ago for the Super Bowl, being an American, that was my job, working sports. It was the Super Bowl. I was there. It's the only Super Bowl I have not been able to see. Why? Because Panama was in some damn Copa Championship game. And I could not find one place to catch that game. All right. We're not done yet, Nikolai. We have one more quick segment.
Okay.
But to the audience, my final take on this is I support importing a few thousand vetted geniuses for citizenship, even the whole brouhaha. But not when it's tech and non-tech companies are seeking cheap labor and better margins under the guise of addressing a talent shortage. So I will push back a little bit on Rachel. I agree with her. The border's the bigger problem. But as we all know, government programs never grow smaller. They just grow bigger, bigger, and bigger. All right. Let us get to fired up hot takes. So our hot takes consist of a yes or no with a few seconds to state why, and we move on. So let's start it off with a global outtake. Does Xi Jinping's claim that China will reunify with Taiwan that he stated just the other day mean war is on the immediate horizon?
No, I don't think he's that stupid.
Ms. Rachel and Nikolai.
No, I don't think he's that stupid either. And I think now with Trump coming in, I just don't see that happening. I think they thought they had their chance and they've missed it.
There's no weak link in the U.S. government anymore. It's probably how they're thinking.
And China is just, you know, that we talked about this. China is just not in a good place right now.
Economically, yes. Yeah. Yes, I don't mean to interrupt. This is what we call the hot takes, the quick. It's Miss Annette.
I'll just say no, because they said it really well. No, agreed.
All right, let's move on to geopolitics. Ukraine versus Russia. Will Ukraine's halt on Russian gas transit, they just shut down the pipeline legally. It was part of the contractor agreement. Would that lead to diminished NATO and European support for Zelensky, signaling his political decline? Based on the fact Europe is so dependent on those gas pipelines, gee.
No, because I think Britain, the second head of NATO, wants war with Russia. I believe that.
Wow. Ms. Annette.
I think yes on this one.
Ms. Rachel and Nikolai.
I think Europe wants war with Russia. I agree with gee.
I think that they're going to, because it's a lot of virtue signaling in Europe. So I think they're going to pretend like they're going to be supportive of Ukraine no matter what, but they're going to be hurting and it might long term affect the way they see the Ukraine, but not initially.
I think it will signal the decline because I agree with both G and Nikolai. Europe wants war, but Europe doesn't have a pot to pee in. And they're dependent on the United States of America. And with Trump in there, war will not happen. Let's go international. The Trump threat is Trump's aggressive rhetoric against Hamas becoming Reagan-esque with the hostage crisis where the hostages came home before Reagan took office with Carter. Is the same thing happening here with Hamas and the potential release of some of the civilians they still hold? Gee.
I say yes. Hamas is thinking, what's our end game now at this point? And they can't think of one.
Ms. Annette.
Well, I say yes, too, because I was with some people on New Year's Eve that were talking about this very topic, and I think they're a lot more plugged in than me, and an absolute yes.
Are you sure that wasn't the champagne talking?
No, was not.
Ms. Rachel and Nikolai.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes. I think that Trump has been so strategic before he left office the first time with Saudi Arabia, with the UAE and elsewhere. He's not messing around in this region. So, yes, absolutely.
I think Hamas has bitten off more than they can chew this time.
Mm-hmm. Big John, I want you to hop on. I'll hold off on this question because I want your take because it pertains to you directly. Now, let's talk a little bit of politics before Big John jumps on. Sheldon Whitehouse, a senator from Rhode Island, I believe, Rhode Island or Delaware, declared war on the GOP and is urging Democrats to battle Trump. Can Trump bridge the political divide here? Let's start with Rachel and Nikolai here.
In what sense, war? War against?
Oh, war, meaning stopping any Republicans. He wants the economy. He's all for the economic. He's looking at 2026.
It's weird how everything's softening now. You know, you've got like all the big talk show hosts now, you know, they go and see now and kiss the ring to a certain degree. I think that's what's going to happen. I think they realize that the game has been lost on their end and they're going to have to make nice. You know, for the next 4 years at least. And so I think that there's going to be a much more of a softening. I don't think that this is going to be warlike, war footing as it was the first 4 years. He won in a landslide. Like, correct. Everyone knows that. It's over. So that's right. What I see it.
Yeah. I agree. Left has egg on their face a little bit. I think it's time for some humble pie, but who knows? He's quite good at making people upset and angry. So we'll see.
That is true. Gee.
Yeah, I think they'll give them a few things in the first 2 years, and then they'll see how 2026 shapes out. And then if they can, they'll try to make them a lame duck as soon as possible. So like Rachel said, the first time around, people thought it was a fluke. This time around, it was decisive, his victory.
Yeah. Agree. Annette?
I think they're doubling down with the way they're talking in the media. But behind closed doors, they're kissing the ring for sure.
I can't argue that. I would sit there and say they're going to go to war just because they're doubling down on their talk. They may lose the war, but I think they're going to try to go to war. All right, let's bring Big John here. This question is specifically based on what he said. Last week, Big John talked about the abuse of power with Elon Musk. And I said, hey, I'm not concerned with him abusing power. But he has intentionally targeted conservatives who have called him out for the H-1B policies he wants to push. Is he already abusing his power to demonetize, to decertify people on X, conservative leaders? Big John.
No, he's not abusing his power. I mean, when he did it to rid X of his political opponents leading up to it, it was fair game. It's fair game now.
He's also
rooting out a lot of anti-Semitism lately, too. So there's been a lot of demonetized accounts, not just for H-1B, but also for anti-Semitic tropes. So, yeah, he's flexing his muscles. And if you believe in a free market before this, you should believe in a free market now. So he's exercising his rights.
Okay, I'm going to deviate a little bit. I have to follow up. Last week you were talking about him abusing the power on X and the platform, and now you're saying, hey, it's a free market.
No, I'm saying he is abusing his power. I'm saying that. But it's – like I predicted, it's only – he was never MAGA to begin with. He's just turning it on the people that are annoying him now. So, hey, turnaround's fair game.
Gee.
I mean, I've only heard of him doing that to Laura Loomer, and at least that's what she says. And like you said, she's kind of a minor player for MAGA. So I say he is, but I need more evidence.
Outstanding. Ms. Annette.
I mean, I said this about Elon before. I mean, I appreciate him. I really appreciate what he did with X. But he's not a saint. So I sort of agree with G. The verdict's out for me right now about this.
Miss Rachel and Nikolai.
I don't know. I mean, I'd have to go and read again what exactly Laura Loomer said. She did say things that were quite incendiary and did sound, a bit like race baiting. I've got to look at her exact quotes or, you know, what she exactly wrote. But I do think, I mean, there's going to be lots of things that we don't like to read or hear from other people. And it is a freedom of speech issue. And I think that this, you know, for me, it's these social platforms have taken on a power that, you know, I mean, especially when you can basically take a president off a social platform, which we saw with Trump, you know, in the beginning, you know, it's scary because these are really our main forms of communication now. And I think that he probably needs to take heed of that a little bit more when you start silencing, language that you just don't like. There's a difference between hate speech and speech that, you know, kind of straddles. You know what I mean?
My European perspective is that you can be arrested for saying things in Europe that people don't like. So, yes, as John said, he's abusing his power, but in this country, thankfully, I guess it's fair game. But, you know, in Europe,
It's ironic because the police constable came out and said, you come to England, we're going to arrest you. Remember some months back? Right, Okay.
Well, and one last thing. Gee, it's not a small following. Laura Loomer has 1.5 million followers. I just checked. She's significant.
John.
Yeah.
John, he meant in terms of her role in MAGA, getting them elected, and in terms she was an outlier in that sense. But you're right. That's why this caught everybody's attention, was because of her following, and she has a lot of support.
And the reason why we know about Laura Loomer is, like you said, because she has 1.5 million followers.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Social economics, not terrorism. I'm looking at it from this perspective. Was Shams for the New Orleans domestic terrorism attack there, or maybe it was just terrorism? Was Shamsuddin Jabbar, was his radicalization driven by personal crises like debt, unemployment, and living in squalor? I'll start. Yes, it was. That is how these movements prey on people. I saw it in Panama all the time. You get the poor, you get those who feel no hope, and you radicalize them. Annette, your thoughts? Was he or wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he's disenfranchised, but I'm sorry, but I look at someone like that and think that they're mentally ill. No one can.
Well, that's a fair answer. No, that's a very fair answer. No argument here. Big John.
I don't know. What does the Army do to you? Both attacks were Army veterans from the same station.
The one in Vegas, there's still a lot to figure out on that one. But no, the Army does not teach you that.
Okay.
He served 10 years, started a real estate program, everything went to hell, wasn't able to hold down the job. So all this was post Army.
I'm being sarcastic by jumping the gun like many on X did when they said it was illegal immigrants that drove across the border to do these attacks. So I was trying to make a point. But having attempted it, failed at sarcasm, I will say, I don't know what drove him to this. Who really knows, right? The guy is dead. Unless someone speaks forward that knew him intimately, a psychiatrist or something, how will we ever know? But you're right. Political movements always prey on the disenfranchised. You don't see billionaires signing up to become suicide bombers. So there's some truth to what you say. Are they billionaires?
Yeah, but
are
not the people
billionaires?
That actually throwing
the
themselves up.
Yeah,
but the leaders aren't throwing themselves up. They're giving people special visas.
Osama did not drive a truck anywhere.
Right, you know, that's my point.
He did not get his pilot's license, you know.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
I'm sorry, who's next on your G?
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of bullet points to what it was, and yeah, if he was living in a penthouse on Fifth Avenue, he probably would not have done this, but you know, there might have been other factors. I wouldn't be surprised to see that maybe there's some race hustling going on and he felt disenfranchised because of he wasn't white. You know, I mean, there could be a lot of factors. So I'll say yes, your points do contribute to the squalor and all that to what he did.
Nicola, let's hear from you before Rachel this time.
Okay. I mean, it's a very difficult question. Does poverty lead to crime? Sure. Does it lead to someone driving a truck through a bunch of New Year's Eve revelers in New Orleans? I'm not sure. But don't forget also that if we do find out this was, you know, some form of radicalism, they're promised and believe that they're going to be given, you know, endless virgins and rivers of milk when they reach the heaven. So who knows? It's something that we can't really relate to. I don't know.
So we know he wasn't lactose intolerant then.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe he'll find out that he was and shouldn't have killed himself, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rachel. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so, I mean, you see, I remember reading this whole thing about the rise of radical Islam in Europe, and especially on the outskirts of Paris and in London as well. And what they found was second generation young men who feel like they're isolated because their parents don't speak English. They, you know, feel alone. They don't really know the culture. They feel isolated. And so they're groomed. They're basically groomed by the local a temple and by, you know, radical clerics who bring them in and make them feel like, you know, this is all about being wanted and being needed and feeling fulfilled and being part of a community. It's like when you lose your job. It's like we're talking about here. Same thing. It's not having a purpose, and they found their purpose. And I think this is, she goes back to the what we were speaking about in the beginning, you know, unemployment and yada, yada, yada. And but, you know, poverty and what happens is, you know, not having a purpose in life. And I think that it's very easy to be groomed when you're vulnerable and you feel like you just don't have a connection with the community.
It's like
and so I think that's what's happened.
It's like sexual grooming, but it's religious grooming.
Yeah.
I no argument for me. All right, let's keep moving here then. And, oops, I'm sorry. I just lost my... Here we go. Historical reinterpretation. I saw an interesting article. Two historians, presidential historians, Kai Bird and Jonathan Alter, were literally revising history to sit there and say Jimmy Carter's presidency was great despite economic and foreign policy failures. Will they succeed, and will history show Jimmy Carter as a great president down the road? Let's start with Ms. Annette.
He's a great man, but not a great president. I mean, will they be able to alter that those historical facts that much? I mean, I think he's going to go down as like people really loved him. And that's the thing that people are feeling right now, that he was a great human being. But I mean, I don't think that's going to really, they're not going to be able to change the fact that his presidency was just not so great.
Big John, but before you answer, he was a terrible businessman selling the Panama Canal for only a dollar. Your thoughts?
Jimmy Carter's one of the three worst presidents of the 20th century. Him, FDR, and Nixon are the three worst presidents in the 20th century. Gee. Take your order of those three. I was going to say, take your order of who was the worst.
I just
I'm glad he didn't say Reagan or a libertarian. I'll just say really quickly, two talking points that I've seen in many articles. One, he never used malaise in his malaise speech, the word malaise. And two, he was president – unfortunately, during the bad times, right? So things were out of his control. They didn't talk about his lack of leadership and failure as a president. So, no, they won't succeed because he was the only guy who lost after 4 years in the 20th century.
Rachel and Nikolai.
I have some sympathies to when someone dies to really not attack them right away, you know, and I think that there's some sort of decorum, I think, you know, in hopefully in journalism where you just don't go after someone right away. I think, you know, there is some sort of honor, I think, though, that should be where like let someone die and say something nice about them for a little bit. But I completely agree. You know, he was a terrible president, and we just talked about, you know, how the whole hostage crisis was just an absolute disaster. I mean, everyone remembers the lines, the gas lines around the, you know, the block, all that stuff. You know, it was malaise, like you said, G. And, you know, I just think that there's a way that Democrats are always going to have revisionist history, you know, just like they even say about Reagan, horrible things about Reagan. Still to this day, I mean, two landslide elections. I mean, one of the greatest, you know, presidents, the greatest president in U.S. history. And, you know, and they still slam him, but, you know, whatever. Right. But you know, I think, you know, they're going to do the same with someone like Carter. But no, I think he did a lot of great things when he left office, but he was a terrible president. He just was.
Nikolai is an outsider. Any thoughts?
It's a similar to the royal family, isn't it, in the UK? I mean, that's a whole nother ball game. But, you know, the Queen gets abused the second after she dies, and she's been one of the only constants in all our lives and all our parents' lives. So, yeah, I think there should be a little bit more decorum, but it's not going to happen.
I love the royal family, but don't talk about that queen. That queen, to me, she symbolized so much, not because of her longevity, but she brought a country together more than once. Big John,
I was going to say, the one good thing about Jimmy Carter's presidency is he gave empirical proof that Keynesianism is entirely wrong.
That's true.
He gave the empiric proof because he had simultaneous high unemployment and runaway inflation, which Keynesians claimed you could never have. So if he did one good thing, Lord Keynes, our friend from England, was proven empirically wrong by Carter.
Yeah. I was in fifth grade when they announced the sale or the turning over of the Panama Canal, and I saw two dictators. I was the protected American citizen. I was untouchable as all American citizens, but my family lived in fear. And even as a fifth grader, I'm thinking, how can he turn over this canal to two people who are going to abuse it? And sure enough, they did. So Rachel, you're absolutely correct. I forgive Carter because I think he actually thought and believed he was helping people.
Yeah, when
he really wasn't. But he was a moron as a president. But God bless him and his family for feeling the pain of losing Carter there. Okay. Political influence. Was Obama the biggest political loser of 2024? He lost his influence over the black vote. He lost his endorsement power influence and his status as a Democratic kingmaker. Big John, yes or no and why?
No. I never got the feeling he was fully invested in this. I mean, again, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. But I never got the impression that his heart was in anything. If he really wanted to flex his muscles, he would have ran his wife for president to get the nomination. That would have been political influence. That didn't happen. So I would say I don't think he was in the game this time around, not seriously.
Annette.
I totally agree with John.
Outstanding. G.
Most people that he's endorsed since 2010, I believe, have lost. And he's lost. Yeah. So many governorships, he's lost state houses. I mean, he's lost that. And he did win re-election in 2012, but yeah, he's absolutely lost a lot of his power.
Rachel and Nikolai.
I totally agree with G. Sometimes you just, it's just like Hillary. It's like, you should know when, like, read the room and know when it's your time to leave, exit stage left. And he should have done it a long time ago. Make your billions off your Netflix documentaries and whatever your books and build your second house in Hawaii or whatever the hell it is. It's just leave us alone, you know, let someone else come up the ranks and play that part. But yeah, I'm glad that he didn't have as much sway this cycle.
If he were serious, he would have done a bit more to make sure that Joe Biden did not appear ever in public, and also Nancy Pelosi personally. But anyway, yeah, I don't think he didn't really care. I agree with Big John.
I don't think he's ever cared of anything once he left office. I think he's nothing but a frat guy. He is a product of the media. So he has lost it, but the truth is he never had it. People voted for Obama. Black Americans voted for Obama. Progressives voted for Obama. They didn't care what he had to say. They just wanted to make their statement, I support the first black president. Outside of that, as G said, all of his a good chunk of his endorsements always fail. And a demented old fool in Joe Biden outmaneuvered him here because his heart was in the game, but it has cost him in the future. Final question. Bonus question. I had to tweak it from what I sent out this morning. Were you shocked that Republican Congressman Mike Johnson won the House speakership in the first round with only one voter voting against him, Libertarian Thomas Massey, who is a registered Republican, though? We'll start with you, Big John, since it was Massey who voted against him.
Well, I think he won in the second round, right? But
First round,
yeah. Oh, no, I'm not surprised that Johnson won because Trump ordered it, so.
Okay, but in the first round, you didn't think there was going to be more than one round?
I thought it might go two rounds, but tops. But, I mean, Trump issued the command from Mar-a-Lago, so it's like all good MAGAs had to fall in line or else they'd be primaried. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I expected Johnson to go through
it. That's what you call a mandate. It has nothing to do with Trump as much as Obama did the same when he took office. Gee, your thoughts?
I'm not surprised at all because who are the alternatives? Elections are about alternatives, and who would be better than Mike? So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
A YouTube playlist of
G is a true politician. Last week he said, no, he won't get reelected. Rachel and Nicola.
Because I thought about it, and that was 2 weeks ago, and I'm like, who else would do it?
I mean, my favorite was when they were like showing kind of all the photos from, you know, the election, you know, and the campaign and all the stuff. And when Johnson was there with like Musk and Trump, and it's just like,
on the plane.
It was just so funny because he just kind of sticks out like a sore thumb, but, you know, he's a little vanilla, but you know, I get it. You know, it's kind of good to just have someone that's not too high drama in that role. So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
A little stability would be nice.
Annette.
Agree. I wasn't surprised at all. I really like him. Maybe because he isn't drama. Maybe that's a good point that you guys made.
Yeah. I was going to.
What?
I was going to say for Annette, one thing we've learned is if you're like a really devout Christian around Trump, you don't do well when you think about Pence and Johnson, you know, because from what I understand, they're like really devout Christian men, right? So, and they're the ones who really have had these really like public, dressing down by Trump. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with it or if it's just dumb luck, but. Yeah, both of them.
Has nothing to do with it.
Pence no. Like,
would seem to be unChristian-like, but he's a Christian. But we're human, and human.
No, I don't mean just Christian. There aren't they like super devout? Is what I like. I think
Pence plays the part, and
Pence and Johnson too, right? Yeah. And Johnson as well, right?
So I don't know. My take is simple. I thought it would go 3 or 4 rounds. I said 2 weeks ago, who else is there? He's going to win. But I thought that he would take 2 to 3 rounds. I was stunned when it was just 1 round. And I think most of the media was stunned also. But, hey, maybe as Big John is correct, the edict from Trump. And that's what happens when you have a mandate. When you have a mandate, the party will fall in line. A mandate is telling the party, I am running the party. And this is what I've always said. Obama and Trump have been voted in by the people. And that's what gave them their mandates. And with that, my friends, that is our show. We're going to have to work on the hot takes here. But it was a great response, great answers. Nikolai and Rachel, thank you. Thank you for coming on. And Nikolai, thank you for talking about being an H-1B recipient. And tell the audience, is there anywhere they can find you? Are you guys on social media? Or I'm not sure. I don't want to put you in the spot.
Oh,
social media?
Social media, really. No.
No worries if you're not. You're private Americans. And that's I'm sorry. You're private American and a Brit.
There we go.
Gee, tell everybody how they can find you.
Yeah, on X, they can find me at SDJEEOP. And I retweet. I don't produce my own content. Too busy for that.
Miss Annette.
Nowhere. You know, I can't do it. I can't get into it.
That's fine, but tell us about your book.
Oh, my book, Where Fairy Tales Go. I need to, I'm working on my second one. So,
nice. And Big John, tell us about Free For All.
Every Thursday night, Free For All. Go to freeforallshow.com, right here on grumblingsmedia.com. And it's a libertarian talk show. I get away from these Republicans. So if you ever want to show up and check out some libertarian thoughts, feel free to do so. Thursday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern.
That's why the Republican has jumped in there as a co-host.
I publish an e-zine called it's the rsfpost.com. So it's our local little platform for the community, for the community, by the community. So it's something that I really enjoy, and G and Annette have contributed many times to it. So,
but we're not twerkers on TikTok or anything like that.
Well, then Big John has no interest.
I was going to say, more's the shame. More's the shame.
I'll make sure that gets in our notes. And for the rest of you out there, you can find me not only on Fired Up, our conservative talk, but I do Points on the Board with, and they're too good looking. You know, Annette and Bill, that's a beautiful looking family. I host that show with Bill Ross, Annette's husband, and we talk sports in relation to politics. And I also do a pop culture or culture show called Red, White, and Rude, where politics is downstream of culture, so I make sure you're aware of what's happening. And with that, everybody, thank you for tuning in. And thank you to Miss Rachel and to Miss Nikolai for attending. And until next week, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Adieu.